Access number 30,001, Peter Est, Relay Team. Now, the next thing is this flying boat journey you made to join the Central Flying School in Bloemfontein on a free strait, South Africa.
Yes.
Now, that was what, in September, I think, 43, or might have been October.
I think it's about September.
What do you remember of that flight? Because that's quite an unusual. Well, those flying boats are quite.
Well, it was. I think they called themselves British Airways, but it was part of the organised British airline system, and they had these flying boats, which were something akin to the short Sunderland flying boat that they. I don't know what name they called them, but they were quite comfortable aircraft to fly in, and built for passengers, of course.
And what was the journey like? I mean, it's a long way to go, isn't it?
Yes, we went from Cairo, took off on the River Nile, and then we had our first stop at Wadi Halfa, I think it was, down about halfway to Lake Victoria. And we stopped and refueled there. And then we went on again, and we went to Lake Victoria and landed there. And that was our first day's flying. I can't remember where we stayed now, but somewhere. I'd have to get my logbooks.
Well, it looked like Kisumu.
Hmm?
Kisumu.
Oh, that's about it, yes. Yes. Then the next day we went on, flew across to Mombasa, and we flew from to Mombasa in one hop. It wasn't all that long. And I remember when we went there, on our right hand side was Mount Kilimanjaro, very tallest mountain in Africa. I can't remember the height of it now, but it's about 20,000 feet, I think. And I think we had a night in Mombasa, and then we went down the east coast of Africa. What's the next stop?
Looks like Mozambique.
Mozambique, that was about right, yes. And we spent the night there, Mozambique, and that was interesting because it was a little tiny place. Where we stayed, and a little tiny hotel, and there was a small railway, a single track railway going down, and there was a small station there, and the station master was a tremendously strong chap. He was as wide as he was tall, and massive arms, and we were there having a drink in the bar at the station hotel, such as it was, about one room, I think. And I shall never forget this man. He said, "I'll show you something I can do." And he got a piece of board, about half an inch thick, 3/4 inch thick, and only a short length, about 2 or 3 feet. And then he got a big 4-inch nail. He wrapped a piece of paper and put it in the palm of his hand, then put the head of the nail into the paper, and then just brought his arm up and crashed it down into this board. And he drove that nail with his hand through that board. It amazed me. And
you weren't tempted to have a go?
No fear. And I also remember that stop there at Mozambique. Anyway, the next day we went on. It was our next stop. Eventually we finished up at Durban, but I think we had a refueling stop in between. Anyway, we went to Durban and had a night stop in Durban. And then we went on the next day from Durban to Johannesburg. Now, with a flying boat, there's a tremendously big lake. It must be quite deep to take flying boats, and south of Johannesburg, and that's where we landed. and transport was laid on to take us into the centre of town, and we were put up there in a transit camp, which was very comfortable. But it so happened that when I was in the desert, I had a South African lieutenant in my flight in the 238 squadron. And he said, "Oh, if you're going to Johannesburg, you must go and see my parents." And he gave me their details, and I made contact with them. And they said, "Oh, don't stay in that transit camp, come and stay with us." Which I did. And they had a very comfortable place there. And so during my period of waiting, which was 2 or 3 weeks as far as I can remember, I stayed with them. It was very comfortable. And I used to go to various parties with them where they got invited. They always included me. And I had a very good social life in Johannesburg in a place called Dunkeld, which was one of the better parts of Johannesburg.
Now, so what next then? You've got a fairly nice social life there. Where now?
Then
it's
from there...
You go to 62, Edinburgh,
yes,
isn't it?
We had a date to report, and I can't remember.
That'd be in October then, if you were there.
That was about it, yes. And went down to... what was the name of the place you mentioned just now?
Bloemfontein.
Yes, yeah, Bloemfontein. We stayed in the officer's mess there, which was quite comfortable. And then it wasn't long before we started flying on Tiger Moths, doing a central flying school.
Now, what was the setup of the 62 Air School? It's part of the central flying school, isn't it? What was the setup? How was it all organised?
It was organised by the South African Air Force, but mainly staffed. Was 50% staffed by Royal Air Force instructors. And we had some of each in our flight, and they used to take us up in the Tiger Moths and show us what an instructor had to do. Giving, you know, they had a set wording and a transcript you had to know. I mean, we could all fly Tiger Moths, it wasn't a question of that, it was knowing how to put it across.
Was there a specific form of words or patter?
Yes. And you had to get it right.
What sort of thing? I mean, was it just things to say or what?
Well, when you were preparing for takeoff, you'd have a certain patter, to an order of things to go through. And you had to stick to that order. Check the throttle, check this, check that, and then right, we're ready for takeoff. Check the that it's clear for takeoff, and you always position the aircraft at right angles to the takeoff line, and then you could look over and you could see it was all clear. Then you turn into wind and take off, and then you go through the patter saying, right, I'll code the control column. Push the control column forward to get the tail up, and as soon as the tail's up, ease it back and hold it in a level position, and then let the aircraft take itself off. When it gathers speed.
There was one of these patters for every landing,
yes,
or anything
else. Yes, everything.
Did it take long to learn?
Not really, no, because we knew the order of things from a flying point of view. It's just a question of getting the patter right. No, it didn't take too long.
Now, what about the Tiger Moth? How did you find that after all the Spitfires and Hurricanes?
Well, I'd flown Tiger Moths before. It wasn't the first time I'd flown them.
Oh, I know that, but did it seem strange going back to it?
Yes, it did a bit. The other thing was that Bloemfontein was about... 5,000 feet above sea level. So therefore, the takeoff took a little bit longer than it did at sea level. You soon got used to that. It wasn't all that much different, but it was not as positive on takeoff. And then when you've got airborne, of course, doing the normal acts, if you went up for aerobatics, height of 3,000 or 4,000 feet, you were about 8,000 feet above sea level. So it was a bit different to...
What did you think of the quality of the recruits?
Well, we didn't have any recruits down there.
What were you training them? Just...
We used to fly with the instructor, and then we would fly with each other. So the chaps on the course.
Just flew alongside you?
Well, we flew, in the same aircraft.
The people under instruction, was the quality as good?
Yes, we all used to practice on each other. And then occasionally you'd have a check with one of the instructors.
So this was a school for instructors, not a school for anyone else?
Oh, yes, just for instructors.
And so there was no actual pupils. Sorry, I misunderstood. There's no actual pupils there. You just instructors learning to be instructors.
No.
Now, anything else about your time there?
It was quite pleasant, and we used to get quite a bit of flying in. And occasionally, two of us would go up together, two of the pupils, as I call them, as we used to call ourselves, and we'd go up and they'd say, go and do some practice and forced landings. And another chap and myself, we used to go to a field about 20 miles away, and it was one of the approved... force landing areas. We used to land there, and sometimes we used to stop the engine, get out and lie on the grass and relax a bit. And of course, to start the Tiger Moth, all you had to do was to swing it, and we knew how to do that. And so one would get in the aircraft and the other one would swing it. So having had 20 minutes or so, half an hour on the ground, relaxing, we'd get back and fly back again, because we were all pretty well old hands from the point of view of flying, so there wasn't a great deal that we could practice.
Now, there's one thing I noticed in your book, there was a bit of a clash you had with some Afrikaners. I'm not quite sure when that was. Was that a cocktail party? I don't know whether that was before you got to the squadron even, but...
That was in Johannesburg before we went down.
Before you went, tell us that story though, because that was quite interesting.
Well, I was with these friends of mine, the parents of this lieutenant in the desert, and they were quite powerful people, really, commercially. And the chap was involved with the press, and with all sorts of things, and they had an invitation to go to the biggest hotel in Johannesburg, the Carlton Hotel. They were saying farewell to one of the chaps in the press world who was either retiring or going to England, I'm not sure which, but anyway, he was leaving Johannesburg. And they gave him a farewell cocktail party at the Carlton Hotel. And it started at about 6:30, and it was going to be a couple of hours, and I was invited along with my friends. It was very nice, and went in the... It was on the first floor of the Carlton Hotel, very nice lounge, big room area, and it was all very friendly, and everybody was talking and chatting, and no drunkenness whatsoever. About 8:30, people were gradually drifting away, and I went along with my friends. We were walking down this long corridor from the room where the party was held down to the stairs. It was on the first floor. And we were going along, not under any influence of drink, but having had an enjoyable evening. And behind me, or behind us, because we had to be in uniform, of course, always had to wear uniform throughout the war. And there was a guttural voice and said, he said, "I'd rather be in German uniform than in the blue uniform that chap in front of me is wearing," referring to me. I thought, oh, my God, I don't very often lose my cool. But I turned round and I slashed him. Knocked him down. I was a bit younger and fitter than I in those days. And when he was down, I gave him a kick up the arse as well. And his wife was screaming blue murder. And my friends said, "Come on, get away from here." And so we hurried down the remaining part of the corridor and down the stairs and into a taxi. And we got away. The next morning, it was a Friday night, this party, and the next morning being a Saturday, we were invited to another luncheon party, private friends. And a lot of English people there who were settled in Joburg. And they came up to me and they said, "What you did last night was absolutely bloody marvellous. We couldn't do it, but it was wonderful to see you do it. This man is a bastard." And they said, "Congratulations." But they said, "You only just got away in time, because this chap had gone downstairs and got some of his chums around, and they were waiting for you with bicycle chains."
Was there a lot of German sympathising amongst the Afrikaners?
Quite a bit, yes.
Was it evident at any other time, or was that it?
No, I don't know, somehow or other it filtered through in various small ways, but that was the biggest one that I came across.
Now, anything else about your time out there? Because you were out there till about February, weren't you?
Yes. Well, I was just doing flying and the CFS, Central Flying Tour. And but then, you know, I'd been through 3 tours of ops during the war, and I knew that we were, you know, things were not approaching the end, but we knew that we were on top. And I thought, my gosh, you know, I've been through all the hard parts of this war. It would be nice to get in at the end when we've got real air superiority. So I went and saw the chief flying instructor. I said, "Look, I really want to finish my war up here in South Africa, having been through France, the Battle of Britain, and the Desert Air campaigns." And I said, "Would it be possible for me to finish this course and go back to the UK? So he said, "Well, I don't know. I'll sound things out for you," which he did. And the authorities agreed on it. And so I went back to Joburg and stayed with my friends again. And I was waiting there, instructions to go to a transit camp in Durban to pick up a boat to come home. But when I was in Johannesburg staying with these friends, another friend, a family friend of theirs, they were Norwegians, and their name was Grinneker, and the boss was always called Pop. He was a chap of about 60, I should think. He was quite a bit older than us. Very nice man. 4 lovely daughters and a lovely house. In the part of Johannesburg where they lived was called Dunkeld. And it was really a very nice part. And I used to go get invited over to their house to various parties, and got friendly with the daughters, who were all very attractive girls, all blonde, being of Norwegian descent. And I went to various, met a lot of good people. I had quite a time awaiting a movement to go to Durban. And this chap, Pop Grinneker, was a building contractor. He was building big blocks of flats and office buildings and that sort of thing building in a big way. And I told him, I said, I've got to go to Durban to pick up a boat. And I suppose I should be going to stay in that transit camp. Oh, he said, you don't understand there. It's not a very nice camp, you know. He said, I've got a very nice flat down there. He was doing some building there, and he said, when I'm doing building, I go and stay in it. He said, go and stay in my flat. So I said, well, that's very kind of you. And he said, I've got to be down there. Let me know when you're going. So when I let him know, I gave him about 2 weeks' notice. Well, he said, I should be down there at that time. So I'll meet you at Durban Station. I travelled overnight by train. It's about 350 miles, I think. And I got there in the morning at about 9, 10 o'clock. And he was there to meet me. And he said, I've brought my servant along with a car to take your baggage. I'd only got two bags. So he said, he can go and take the bags along, and we're going to have a drink. We went to a very nice club, and lo and behold, in there were some English naval officers, and one of them was an old school chum of mine, and he now lives in Cardiff. He's about a year younger than me, but we've been friends ever since we were about that high. And we had a few drinks together, and I told him, I said, I'm staying down here. But when we were on the way to that club, my friend Pop Gunnicker, the Norwegian, said, now I've got something to tell you. He said, I've got to apologise profusely. You won't be able to stay in my flat. I had forgotten that I had agreed that a family friend of ours with her two children we're going to stay there for the school holidays, or part of the school holidays. But he said, don't worry, I've booked you in at the hotel, the best hotel in Durban, right on the Marine Parade. What's the name of the hotel of him?
Doesn't say here, I don't think. Edward Hotel.
That's it. Edward Hotel. I said, I can't afford to stay in a hotel. Oh, he said, don't worry about that. He had loads of money, of course. He said, I'll cover your hotel expenses. So I said, well, that's very kind of you, but I don't know how long I'm going to be there. I don't know how long it'll be before they call us for a boat, whether it's going to be a week or two or maybe even 3 weeks. He said, that doesn't matter either. He said, put everything down, and if you want a drink, don't worry, sign for everything. So I said, well, that's extremely generous of you, and I appreciate it very much. So I went into the Edward Hotel, and one or two other chaps who were RAF officers waiting for, but they went down to the transit camp, and they got to hear that I was in the Edward Hotel, and they used to come in, we used to have drinks together. And I was known as the Uncrowned King of Durban. And so I stayed there, and eventually we got a notification that the boat, a Dutch boat called the New Amsterdam, was going to take us on our own. We weren't going in convoy or anything like that. These big boats used to go on their own at a very fast speed, about 30 knots. So if you did come across any new boats, they would have a hell of a job to get you. And they used to do a circuitous route. So, but it also happened that while I was staying in the hotel, there were some Dutch naval officers who used to go in there, and I was talking to them. I said, we've got to pick up a boat in Durban. They said, you might even come on ours. So if you do, I'm talking to the number two officer in charge of him, what he called himself in the Dutch, it wasn't Dutch Navy, he was in the civilian. Anyway, he said, contact me if you just happen to be on a boat called the New Amsterdam. We got down there, and sure enough, we were on a boat called the New Amsterdam, and I contacted him. And for all the journey, he said, use my cabin. He said, you want to go in with all these other chaps? and you can have what you want to drink, and it makes yourself comfortable. So I did just that, and it was a very comfortable journey. But we went, the route we took, we went from Durban round down, round Cape Town, and then going in a northwesterly direction, we went across to sort of South Africa, South America, and then up the American coast, and then round to Iceland, just south of Iceland, and back into Scotland, right round them from the north. So we went halfway around the world to get there. It took about 3 weeks, and going at about 30 knots the whole time.
So you got back in late March, I think it is?
Yes, that's about it. Can't remember the exact date, but yes.
That's what it says in the book.
Yes, it was late March anyway.
So what happened when you got back? Did you know where you were going to be posted to?
No, hadn't any idea. So I had to report. Can't remember where I had to report to now, but...
Didn't say.
No. Anyway, I think it was the Air Ministry, I think. And they said, oh, well, with your experience, we'll put you with fighters. So I said, okay. And I was posted to number 124 Squadron. And it was called the Baroda Squadron because the Maharaja of Baroda financed the purchase of the aircraft for the squadron. As happened on one or two other squadrons, they were subsidised or financed by some of these wealthy people. So the squadron was known as number 124, and then in brackets, Baroda Squadron. And the Maharaja of Baroda was the chap who financed the
so
aircraft.
So he paid for everything, did he?
Paid for the aircraft, yes.
He sent food parcels as well, didn't he?
Yes.
What were
yes.
they?
Well, of course, we had strict rationing in those days. And we used to get things like chocolate and not basic foods, but what else did we used to get? Anyway, it was very nice. I can't exactly remember what used to be in the packages now.
Now, what was your reception like when you got there?
Oh, very good. And it so happened that the squadron, 124 squadron that I went to, was commanded by a chap named Tommy Barnforth. And Tommy Barnforth and I were together at Grantham, and we were trained together on Harvard's.
So years before?
Yes, late 38 into 39. So that was good for me because to know the CO well, and we were good friends. He was a good rugby player, he was a scrum half, and it was a good squadron.
Well, what was he like, Tommy Barnford, as a chap? Give us any idea, or just gives a snapshot of him.
Yes, he had a good sense of humour. He wasn't a very big chap. He was only about 5'8" tall, I should think. But he was a very good chap. And I was very pleased to be in a squadron with him.
Now, where was the squadron based?
A place called Bradwell Bay in Essex.
That's quite near to where you come from.
Yes, not far away. It was on the south side of the River Mersey.
Mersey?
Was it Mersey?
River Blackwater.
That's it.
Mersey's Liverpool.
Yeah, it's a bit different to the Mersey.